This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 71 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
Hey, Max, and I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. How are we today?
Very good, David, and we have a guest again this episode.
We do. Our guest is Ryan Morton. He's a roboticist and a chief technology officer and co-founder at SkySpex, a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, and both California Polytechnical State University, St. Louis Obispo, and the University of Michigan. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Love the podcast, so happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, we sort of roped you in. You need to warn people that if they send in feedback and we really think it's positive or worth discussing, we suddenly say, you want to come on the show?
Yeah, so all of you be warned. Yeah, really great feedback to us could result in you being in Ryan's shoes. So Ryan, again, thanks for joining us. We're really excited to have you. David, we've got some interesting topics to talk to Ryan about, and we also have a little bit of news to talk about.
Topics this week are Transport Canada makes it, unlike the FAA, easier to fly small UAVs. Ground school for FAS is approved. I'm going to screw up my German after all these years. Fraunhofer is developing flying inventory robots that keep track on stock. Domestic drone casualties, unfortunately, and a video of the week. So I guess we should get started. Well, I guess, Max, instead of starting off with the news, we should talk about the email that Ryan sent us. Started off with, now, and this is a great way to get our attention, folks. You guys are still putting on an awesome show. Keep it up. I wanted to pass on a few UAS-related news items and provide a different perspective on an important topic for all of us. So I guess the first one you brought up was your company was going to deliver footballs to the Michigan State football team. Ryan, you want to tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, well, so first of all, it was the University of Michigan, not Michigan State.
Oh, sorry.
So go Blue. yeah, so you might have heard back in September, there was supposed to be a delivery of a football during the opening ceremony of a University of Michigan football game, which was during the centennial celebration of the Aerospace Engineering Department at the University of Michigan, which happens to be the oldest such program in the country. So it was a celebration. The dean was there. There was a bunch of alumni in. There was a phenomenal flyover. I believe something on the order of 20 planes flew over. It was a wonderful spectacle highlighting the old, you know, World War I, II, up through, you know, Korea and to modern warplanes. And then there was going to be a delivery of a football to midfield out in the middle of, you know, middle of the big house, which is a huge stadium. And it was shut down by the FAA, as I'm sure you and your readers have heard. And it kind of highlights some of the important challenges facing some of us in the UAV space. So, yeah, that was back in September. And as much as it was a bummer not to have that football delivered, it was exciting to be part of the policy conversation.
Well, Ryan, you know, that's an interesting thing that you bring up in that there are obviously a lot of people who are thinking of interesting, creative, fun or otherwise things to do with UAVs. And I think in many cases, people aren't aware of the FAA's view on uses such as this. Do you have a sense for that? Do you think that people are just unaware, or do you think that they know and they don't care? Or what do you think is really happening out there?
Well, I think that the average person isn't aware, but I think most pilots and operators are relatively aware of the operations. Now, that being said, I certainly see people flying their phantoms in parks that are suspiciously close to helipads and hospitals and airports. So I wouldn't say that the average person flying a UEV knows all of the rules, but I think they know certainly what's strictly illegal. And then there's a gray area in the middle that, you know, probably people don't really understand.
Mm. Ryan, what actually was the FAA's reasoning for shutting down the delivery of the football?
So their reasoning was, so it was at a large venue at the Big House, holds on the order of 115,000 people. It's, you know, the largest stadium in the country. And now, of course, the intent of the rule is to prevent, you know, some hoodlums from the tailgate party from flying over and causing a ruckus during these large events. And they heard about it through some kind of a leak, and they expressed that the no-fly zone during this large venue event was in violation and threatened to sue and press criminal charges for the operator of the vehicle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, didn't you recently have the opportunity to talk about UAS, small UAS, at the White House?
I did. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to accompany a law firm, McKinney Long and Albright from D.C., led by Lisa Ellman, as part of an Executive Order 12866 meeting at OIRA. And this was a precursor to the notice for rulemaking that's coming out on the small UAS law. So these EO 12866 meetings, if your audience isn't familiar, is a way for the policymakers and the regulators to get feedback before the actual rule is presented and open for a public comment period. So I was fortunate enough to meet with on the order of 10 people from the government and present some of our views for what these proposed rules should look like. And I will say, we did not see the rules. This was really a one-way conversation presenting our views for what should happen. And to be honest, one of the most informative pieces of information was that, as far as I'm aware, and from the conversation in the room, this was the first such meeting with the public to the government, you know, on this topic.
Hmm, interesting. And when did this take place? Back, this was in the spring of this year, 2014.
No, this was a couple of weeks ago. I believe the 20th of November. I have a link. I'm guessing we'll put in the show notes the rule.
Yes, of course.
The meeting notes from the actual meeting.
It sounds like, if we're going to see the proposed regulations from the FAA by the end of this year, as they say, that sounds like kind of late in the game to be getting input from others. Do you think that, or is it just kind of coming together that quickly?
Well, so I'm not a policy expert. You know, I'm not a DC insider, so I guess we'd have to seek counsel outside for that. I will say that they're getting ready to release these rules. It seems like that they had it on their desk. You could see it in their eyes that they've read various pieces of this and are really looking to get outside feedback for what people want in this rule, possibly to make changes last minute. But my understanding of the regulations getting to the point when they are released to OIRA for these meetings means that it is sufficiently far along that it is on the near horizon to be released to the public. Mm. So when Huerta said in this past week that they're really looking to get this out by the end of the year, I personally believe him. Now, whether it's exactly by January 1st or within the next, you know, few months, my feeling is that these rules are about to be released.
Can you give us just briefly, what were some of the main points that you were trying to communicate at this meeting?
We are communicating one that, you know, similar to a Wired article that I was commented on this past week. The FAA has a daunting task, and I think a lot of the industry and the commentators are pushing back pretty hard on the FAA to get the rules perfect, to stall the process and make sure, you know, let's get certification processes and for both pilots and vehicles, and let's get the regulation perfect the first time. And our view was that is a mistake. As a business owner myself, what we need to do is to get regulations passed. Like, we need regulations. And we could talk all day on idealistic goals for what a pilot certification or what a vehicle certification or what the CONOPS are for various different types of environments that we could fly these vehicles. But at the end of the day, we need something in place, and that's kind of the key, is let's get something out and then iterate. So we want a process where the public and industry personnel can comment and improve the law once it's released. One of the things that we're interested in, of course, is not requiring a pilot to fly these vehicles. That's something I'm very passionate about in my company per se, because we're actually reducing the need for a highly skilled pilot in these low altitude environments. That being said, I believe I understand how these laws and the regulations work, and that it's going to take many, many months, possibly years, to get that right. So I would rather, and also the McKinney, Long, and Albright, along with Measure, which was another startup that joined us, we would rather see some regulations, even if that requires a pilot to fly, which does cut into our margins. That is far superior to waiting another year or 18 months or 2 years to get these regulations passed.
Because you just want to get started.
Exactly. If I could sell to somebody, even if that's a pilot, that's going to cut into my margins, of course. But if there's someone in the U.S. that we can sell a product to, and drones can be out there doing services, you know, reducing the cost of electricity by helping us inspect wind turbines or nuclear power plants or power distribution plants, we can get that technology out there, even if it's a pilot. You know, a Cessna pilot, I think we all agree, any of your listeners probably agree, that flying a 747 or flying a Cessna doesn't really inform on your capabilities to fly a DJI S900 or a Phantom or you know, a 3D robotics, whatever the vehicle is that these individuals will be flying. But that being said, from an enforcement and regulatory and policymaking point of view, you know, living in the real world, I would rather be able to fly this vehicle out there today and not make as much money than wait longer to fly in the perfect regulatory environment.
Ryan, why don't we backtrack a little bit and tell us a little bit about SkySpecs.
So SkySpecs is a company out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. We are mostly University of Michigan alumni that started in the robotics at that university, some doing air, some doing ground. And what we do is we make collision avoidance technologies for drones. We're not a safety company per se. We want to make it so that you can get up close and personal to the things in the world. So most of the drones that are out there right now are high in the sky, they're amongst the clouds, out in the fields. Maybe they get kind of close to your house or kind of close to the building to get that shot, but we want to enable pilots and operators and inspectors and directors and producers of films to get their cameras or whatever sensor they want to fly closer to things to get that shot that they can't get right now. So you might often hear in the UAV space, we talk about the last 50 feet. This is a challenge. How do we handle the airspace in the 50 feet, the lower 50 feet? And SkySpecs is really addressing the last 2 feet or the last 6 inches or the last inch. Let's get all the way down up close and personal with whatever you want to inspect.
And so how does that translate into a product that you offer?
So imagine you want to inspect a wind farm. And you want to inspect the blades of the wind turbine. Right now, you can hire a pilot, and they can get kind of close. But if it's windy, up at 400 feet, you're not going to be able to get as close as you'd like. And it's going to take longer because you have to keep a large distance from the object. We're enabling the pilot or the autonomous system, if that is required, to get closer to the structure, therefore making it simpler to do the inspection. So we're not making the full drone. We started out making actual platforms and flight controllers, but we've really zeroed in on this sensor payload that has some processing on board that connects to other flight controllers and other platforms in order to enable those drones to get close to things. So we've integrated, for example, to DJI and to some of the 3D robotics vehicles, and our little add-on module goes on top of them and allows them to get closer to things without requiring the pilot to be very, very aware of where it is next to that structure.
Interesting, very interesting. And do you see this as a U.S. market or a global market?
It's certainly a global market. And we're raising capital. We're a small startup. There's 8 of us, and you know, we're being pushed, you know, daily by our investors and our mentors to kind of say, get out of the U.S. You know, stop waiting for all these regulations and you know, go to Canada, which as I'm sure you and your viewers are familiar, just passed some regulations that would allow us to actually operate there. So it's definitely a global market, but there's a big market in the U.S. And also, you know, we would like to help the FAA, if possible, to push the regulations in the right direction. And they're very conscious of safety, and our product we believe will help them see that technology can make these drones safer and reduce some of the risks that they're considering.
Ryan, do you have any buddy that you think is making a significant contribution to small UAVs?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that are pushing for small UAVs, including there's this small UAV coalition that you guys mentioned a few episodes ago, and they're doing great things for the industry. And recently, Michael Roback gave an interview on Bloomberg TV, and once again, I think, you know, similar to many in the industry, they're pushing for getting the regulations perfect the first time, and I hope the small UAV coalition and others in the industry realize that we really need something out there, and then we can iterate once it's in place.
All right. Well, David, what do you say we tackle some of the news items we have lined up?
Yeah, well, why don't we, since he just brought it up, why don't we talk about Transport Canada makes it easier to fly small UAVs for work and research. This is from news.gc.canada. Air Transport Canada has introduced two exemptions that will not require a special flight operations certificate, or an SFOC, another one for the list. These are very small UAVs under 2 kilograms and small UAVs between 2 kilograms and 25 kilograms.
So this kind of opens it up. I guess in effect, this is saying that for very small UAVs, very lightweight UAVs, that we're going to treat those as a separate class and not require, as you say, David, a special flight operations certificate. Ryan, I mean, that makes an awful lot of sense to me. I'm kind of hoping the FAA ends up taking that sort of approach, which is to say that there's, you know, some line below which we're going to treat them, and I'll use the word model airplanes or like model airplanes, and not regulate them as heavily. Does that make sense to you?
I think it certainly does. And once again, I mean, there's the ideal regulation and then the most expedient. And determining the class based on weight doesn't really make sense, except from an enforceability point of view. I mean, a 2-kilogram vehicle that is highly capable, made of a really, really dense material, is potentially more dangerous than a 20-kilogram balloon. The weight or the mass restriction is certainly an easy way to distinguish, but once again, let's get regulations in place and then iterate on it. So certainly 2 kilograms is a good start, and I applaud Canada for making progress on this.
Now, we also see from AvWeb an article. This is Huerta says UAS rules stress certification and pilot standards. We talked last week about that Wall Street Journal report that is based on, I guess you'd call it, a leak from the FAA over what the regulations are going to look like, or what the proposal is going to look like. And we said at the time, and I've kind of grown increasingly skeptical that what was reported is what we're going to end up seeing. But certainly a lot of people have kind of jumped the gun, I think, and are drawing all kinds of conclusions based on what they think the FAA is going to propose. But in this article, Huerta confirms that what we're going to see is the regulations by year end. So that's good. But also that what they're looking at is what kind of certification requirements are we going to have for the aircraft, for the UAVs, and what kinds of standards or requirements are we going to have for the pilots? And I guess, David, at this point, I mean, we really don't know if it's going to require a pilot's license or some kind of UAV pilot, UAS pilot certification. We just don't know, do we?
No, and I think we need to wait and see. It does, I mean, it did seem a bit excessive that anybody flying a small UAV would be required to have a pilot's license. And yeah, I mean, the more we step back and look at this Wall Street Journal report is, well, let's wait till the NPRM is out and then we can rush to judgments because we'll have the facts in front of us. Right now, it's a little bit of hearsay, a little bit of fact, and a lot of muddied water. So I agree with what you tweeted that maybe we need to just step back from the abyss and say, okay, we've got a couple more weeks before the end of the year, so let's see what happens.
And we might see changes. I mean, the FAA may modify what they propose from what they started with a month ago. I mean, we've already heard, you know, Ryan, you talk about the fact that they've been receiving input as recently as a few weeks. We understand that the regulation proposal is being circulated within the government, different agencies, different groups who have the ability to comment on that. And yeah, that may lead to changes. So yeah, we just have to wait and see. But I think in the end, there must be some kind of requirement in the regulations for the qualifications for pilots who undertake commercial operations. I personally hope that's not a pilot's license, but there needs to be some kind of an awareness of safety, aviation safety, and in particular. And Tim Trott sent us an article from Unmanned Experts that deals with the training that might be required for UAV pilots. This comes from an item in Unmanned Experts. And what this reports is that Unmanned Experts has teamed up with Gold Seal, which is a provider of flight training services. Now, Unmanned Experts is a UAS consultancy. They offer training and some other services. And these guys have gotten together to create like a UAV ground school course based on manned aircraft training requirements, but focusing in on UAS. Maybe that's jumping the gun as well, but this seems like it's a service that's going to have to be created, at least in some form.
I agree. I mean, there has to be some sort of school system, you know? I mean, and if you really want to get into a business in UAVs and small UAVs, become a proficient flyer and then start teaching good behaviors to the next generation of flyers. What do you think, Ryan? Do you agree?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, at some point, we're going to have some certification process with schools that have been accredited to teach this material. And my view is if the first pass is to require a pilot's license, I'm not happy about it. But once again, I ask your listeners and the people in the industry to say, we either wait to figure out how to do the certification and the qualification and how to determine what does it mean to have a school and to get that whole pipeline set up, or we figure out a way to get these things operating commercially. And certainly in the next few years, we will need these schools, but let's get these things operating. And if the first pass is pilots, well, let's do it.
All right. What's next, David?
This was from flyingmag.com. Domestic drone casualties. This was sent in by Mark. It's an interesting spin on the fact that the radio control hobby is taking a hit because of the FAA rules on small UAVs, and that really there should be a niche carved out for the people who've been flying safely for close to 100 years. I mean, there have been radio controlled airplanes as long as, and control light airplanes as long as there have been airplanes. So it's an interesting small piece that, you know, that says, it's not fair to these radio control pilots and like the Academy of Aeronautics that have been monitoring and providing safety standards for years for radio control. And now they're taking a hit by the FAA because of their broad small UAV rules.
Yeah, it's almost like this whole issue of developing the regulations makes everybody nervous. Every group is nervous. The pilots are nervous about staying clear of drones when they're flying their manned aircraft. As you mentioned, David, the model airplane community, who've, as you say, been operating safely for a long time, is worried about being swept into this whole regulatory environment, something that they have successfully avoided and effectively avoided for all these years. So it's an interesting piece. We'll have a link to this item, as all the stories, in the show notes, and you can take a look at that and read those.
So I guess we should move on to Frank, who sent us a video of the week. It's a DJI Phantom 2 Epic. It's in Dutch, and it's an interesting video. Ryan, did you get a chance to look at it?
Oh, yeah. That's some beautiful footage right there. I wish I had a chapel of that magnitude with that beautiful weather that they show in this video. So your listeners should definitely check this out.
Yeah, the mist surrounding it is really really beautiful. It's quite an artistic video in some ways. Frank mentions that there in the Dutch news, there's some talk about a possible fine that the pilot is facing, an 8,000 euro fine. But also, interestingly, he notes that the dealer, I guess, of the Phantom, has said that if this pilot is charged, that he'd be happy to pay the fine for that amount. So an expensive video in the end, perhaps, but a beautiful one for sure.
So, and of course, because this is how Ryan got on the show, we've got feedback. And again, folks, you are the best audience in the world. Don't ever stop sending us emails. We might not get to it right away, but we do read everything. Max and I scour the globe reading your emails, and you guys do the best show prep for us we could possibly ask for. Our first one is from Patrick, who went back and looked at movie production and discovered that unmanned aerial vehicles have been filming for decades. And the earliest use he could find was 1979, which was kind of amazing. Now, mind you, those things look like more like helicopters and radio-controlled airplanes, but they're unmanned vehicles using for film. So,
yeah, sometimes things you think are new are really not that new, and they've been around a while. So, yeah, thanks to Patrick for illustrating for us the sort of a little bit of the history of using unmanned vehicles in the film industry. They have a long history of that. You can understand why, and you can understand why that's one of the groups that's very, very eager to employ this new technology.
So the next one was from Andy, who sent us a really in-depth discussion on how to fly in national parks. Now, we can't tell you to do that because right now that's illegal. But he did have some interesting recommendations, huh, Max?
Yeah, he did. And we're going to put these in the show notes in much more detail than we have time to go through this episode. So please take a look. But he says first three points that he admits that, you know, he loves the peace and the quiet and the solitude that you can get in some of these beautiful national parks. He doesn't want some joker flying some quadcopter around his family when he's trying to enjoy nature, and he wants to be able to enjoy that without these things in the picture. So that's point number one. Point number two is, but as a photographer and the lover of all things that fly, he says, he also likes getting that kind of unique viewpoint that only a UAV could provide. Then point three is, but point two cannot be at the expense or safety of annoying someone who relates to point one. So how do you do that? Well, he's got some recommendations as to how we might treat flying UAVs in areas like national parks. And I think he's got some wisdom in there. He notes that in these parks, generally the visitors are concentrated into a certain area. And like with other forms of recreation that takes place in national parks, there's this concept of separation. The park's plenty big enough to allow different groups to enjoy the park in their own ways. He says that if you charge a reasonable permit fee, that's one way to get information to the pilot about what's allowed and what's not. He suggests that the pilot be an AMA member or a certified or certificated rather pilot of some sort. That as part of the conditions of a permit, that common courtesy is employed. If there's other people present, then you discontinue flying if there's any objections raised. Also, another point is adhering to the Model Aircraft Operating Standards Advisory Circular, AC 9157. That's the 400-foot limit, line of sight, and so forth. And then finally, no wildlife harassment. So we'll put all this, as I said, in the show notes in more detail. Take a look at it. I think there's some reasonable thoughts that are here, and we really want to thank Andy for sending those along.
So I guess with that, we better wrap this up, where it looks like we're starting to run long. But Ryan, we'll give you your free plug time. Tell us where they can find you on the internet and where they can find your company. So have at it.
You can find SkySpecs at on Twitter at SkySpecs. Also, we are in New York City for the next few months because we are in the RGA Accelerator Program powered by Techstars. So if anybody's in New York City, let me know. We love giving demos. Then we'll be back in Ann Arbor. And I guess the last thing I'll say is let's get these things flying and pass these rules. And happy to hear your comments.
Great. Thanks so much, Ryan, for joining us on the show. This has been episode 71 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com, or you can go straight to the show notes at theuavdigest.com/71.
And of course, you can find us on social media. Twitter, it's at UAV Digest. Facebook, it's facebook.com/UAV Digest. And of course, you can send us feedback, which is feedback@theuavdigest.com, or max@theuavdigest.com, or david@theuavdigest.com. And if you really love us, leave us feedback on iTunes and Stitcher.com. Of course, you can always make a donation to help fund this little organization, and that's at patreon.com/theuavdigest, or go to the donate page on our homepage. And last but not least, just in time for the holidays, you can buy some swag, and that's cafepress.com/theuavdigest, and get your significant UAV fan in the family a t-shirt. Again, we'd like to thank our guest, Ryan Morton from SkySpecs, for being on the show. Thanks, Ryan. And this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
This episode has been sponsored by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com.